Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Banking with Capital One means five times the savings toward your dream honeymoon, or five times the savings toward your family's ultimate vacation, even five times the savings toward just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member, FDIC.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jonathan Savage, and in the early hours of Friday, the 24th of January, these are our main stories. Large-scale Lunar New Year celebrations have been cancelled in Beijing as China tries to stop a potent new virus spreading. The government of Myanmar has responded defiantly to a ruling by the UN's top court ordering measures to prevent the genocide of Rohingya Muslims. Also in this podcast,
the gas chambers in crematoria that turn millions of people into ash. It is the culmination of what can happen when our people have no voice, no land, no shield.
The world remembers the liberation of Auschwitz. The authorities in China have imposed further drastic travel restrictions in Hubei province, where, as we record this podcast, a previously unknown respiratory virus has killed 17 people. Public transport has been suspended in six cities with a combined population of nearly 20 million. They include Wuhan, the provincial capital, where it's believed the coronavirus outbreak began. Chinese state media has confirmed the death of an 18th patient in the northern coastal province of Hebei, which borders Beijing. All large-scale Lunar New Year celebrations have been cancelled in the capital, where the Forbidden City, the sprawling imperial palace popular with tourists, has been closed. This report is from our Beijing correspondent, John Sudworth.
This is the moment caught by a TV news channel that a city of 11 million people is effectively shut off. Paramilitary police closed the gates at the station entrance as all departing trains are cancelled. In Wuhan's hospitals, medical staff in full protective bodysuits are treating hundreds of infected patients, while images on social media appear to show crowded reception areas with queues of people wearing masks and a system struggling to cope. On China's main evening news, the lead item: a New Year banquet for senior officials. But the face masks on display at this Beijing station are proof the public is well aware of the risks.
A little worried because
you're wearing a mask.
Mask. This one.
And goggles as well.
Yeah.
You're really taking all the precautions.
Yeah.
Are you worried about the virus?
No, because I believe my country.
You believe in your government?
Yes.
Alongside the official promises of transparency, though, there are signs of censorship and control. And as whole cities are forced into lockdown, questions are being quietly asked whether more might have been done sooner.
John Sudworth. What then is it like to live in a city in lockdown? Karen Lambert is a British citizen who's stuck inside his central Wuhan apartment. John Sudworth spoke to him.
To be in the middle of a city where an epidemic has started is a very surreal feeling. You know, knowing especially that if you go outside, there is potential to catch such a deadly virus is very surreal. And it's getting quite boring, actually, because I've been locked myself in the house for 4 days now and I've just watched movies over and over again, you know, so it gets quite boring, actually.
What did you think when you heard that they had put the city under lockdown, that even if you wanted to, it was no longer possible to leave?
For me, I'm not too bothered about that. You know, like, I had a trip planned to Taiwan. I've cancelled that. You know, for me, as long as I'm safe and healthy and fine like that, I'm absolutely, you know, it's no bother to me. My problem is that my grandmother is here. visiting from the UK. She was supposed to return to the UK next Monday, but she's received an email from the airline saying that her flight was cancelled. And I'm a bit worried now because she only brings enough medication to survive her trip. So now I have to try and source medication in case she needs to stay longer, which is quite worrying.
What about food? Are you worried about the availability of supplies?
I am, yes. I went out this morning to get some food and I went to the supermarkets. The shelves were empty already, and that was at 10 o'clock this morning. I ended up getting a few bits, but again, I was paying over the price for them. I paid £9 for a few carrots that would normally cost me about £2.50. So, you know, the retailers are now trying to make the money in a situation like this, which is terrible, really.
And what does the city look like? Do you feel the effects now? Does it feel like a city that's living under this blanket of fear?
Oh, yeah. 100%, 100%. Behind me here, if you saw the street here at nighttime where I normally live, it's a very vibrant street, lots of restaurants, and it's open until 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, and Chinese families come and they're celebrating. But if I show you out there now, it's dead. The restaurants have been closed all day. There's nobody out there. The streets are empty.
Have you had a chance to get a sense of what people, you know, your neighbours, Chinese colleagues, contacts of yours are thinking? Are people very worried about this, or is there a sense of people being fairly philosophical and assuming that as long as they stay indoors, they'll probably be okay?
I think there's a bit of both, really. I think, you know, yesterday everything was very philosophical. And then since the shutdown happened this morning, I think there's been a bit more panic, you know, especially when you think about food and the fact that it's Chinese New Year, people are now going to be able to go and see family, etc. And, you know, in Chinese culture, that's a massive thing, you know, seeing their family at this time of year. So today, when the shutdown happened and it started at 10 o'clock this morning, a bit more panic kicked in.
What sort of communication are you getting from the authorities?
It's a lot of hearsay at the moment. There's been no official, as far as I'm aware, English release of documents or, you know, official English version of releases. And to be honest with you, my Chinese reading skills are not that good. So for me to understand the Chinese is difficult. But I'm just hearing things through Weibo, through WeChat. But the problem with that is a lot of rumours have started also on things that have not actually happened. And so you've got to really take everything with a pinch of salt until we hear something official.
Karen Lambert. Now, following a second day of talks, the World Health Organization has again decided not to declare an international public health emergency over the outbreak. Larry Gostin is a professor of global health law at Georgetown University in the US. Does he think that closing off a major city and putting it under quarantine can stop an epidemic?
We did try to do something way back in the great flu of 1918. It didn't work. There's no evidence it works, and there's a quite considerable worry that it could backfire badly.
But isn't it going to, at the very least, slow the spread of infection? If the place where it all originated, where there have been most infections, it's just more difficult for people to travel out of.
Yes, it's more difficult to travel out, but if you think that you've got a city of 11 million people, highly congested, you're going to have people infecting one another, and eventually they will leave. But the most important rule of public health is that you have to gain the trust and cooperation of the population, and this will drive the epidemic underground. It will mean that individuals and their families won't go to hospital or their doctors to be tested and treated.
Forgive me for interrupting. Why do you think that it will stop people from going to hospitals to be treated or tested?
Well, because they'll be fearful and panicky. That was the experience with all the other epidemics, from, you know, SARS through to Ebola in Africa. People get worried. They get worried that they're not going to be able to have food and medicines. They get worried that they're going to be infected, and they just hunker down. You know, if you don't have mass transport, it's really hard to get to the hospital. So I think there are all kinds of reasons. But here's the bottom line. We've been able to bring other novel coronaviruses under control through traditional public health measures like SARS and MERS. When we had SARS, for example, we never shut down a city. Canada had limited what they call work quarantine, so health workers could only go between work and home. And in China, Hong Kong, Singapore, and other places, they had limited quarantines of, say, apartment buildings. But can you think of the nightmare of trying to close down a city bigger than London, the size of New York City? The violations of human rights, the fear. I'm gravely concerned that this has never worked in the past.
Professor Larry Gostin talking to the BBC's Tim Franks. The government of Myanmar has rejected a ruling by the International Court of Justice that Rohingya Muslims are still at serious risk of genocide in the country, accusing human rights groups of distorting the facts. The UN's top court has ordered Myanmar to put emergency measures in place to protect the minority group. Thousands of Rohingya died and many others fled to Bangladesh during an army crackdown in 2017. Anna Holligan sent this report from The Hague.
Myanmar must take all measures.
The judges recognise the Rohingya as a Muslim minority at risk of extinction and in urgent need of protection. There are some 600,000 Rohingya still in Rakhine State. They said Myanmar must stop any killings or acts to prevent births, ensure its military doesn't commit genocidal crimes, and prevent the destruction of evidence of genocide. Plus, it must report on compliance with those measures within 4 months, and again, every 6 months, until the court reaches its final judgment on whether Myanmar is guilty of deliberately trying to destroy an entire ethnic group. This international lawsuit was brought by The Gambia. The country's lawyer, Paul Reichler, told the BBC the decision was hugely significant.
It is a historic day for international law and for the protection of human rights of vulnerable peoples. I think today you can say that the International Court of Justice lived up to its name.
Last month, Myanmar's de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi argued that international intervention was unnecessary and would exacerbate tensions in the fragile state. By taking part in the proceedings, Ms. Suu Kyi has in effect recognised the court's legitimacy, and it will now be difficult for Myanmar to ignore its ruling. And while the judges don't have any enforcement powers, today's decision has increased pressure on the international community not to ignore what's happening.
Anna Holligan. Prosecutors in Bulgaria have issued European arrest warrants for three Russians wanted in connection with an alleged attempt to poison a Bulgarian arms dealer in Sofia in May 2015. The prosecutor's office has not named the three, but one suspect in the case is believed to have links to the nerve agent attack on the former Russian spy Sergei Skripal in England in 2018. Michael Schwertz is an investigative reporter with the New York Times and has been following this story.
In 2015, a man by the name of Emelyan Gebrev, who is a prominent arms manufacturer in Bulgaria, got sick and lost consciousness at dinner with business partners in Sofia in Bulgaria. And initially, Bulgarian investigators didn't know what to make of it. And prosecutors, after initially thinking that it was a case of food poisoning, settled on a theory that he had been the subject of an assassination attempt. But initially, it was thought to be the work of business rivals, Bulgaria being a place where contract killings over business and politics was not unusual. And the case didn't generate a whole lot of attention and was quickly closed until March 2018, when there was another poisoning, this time in the UK, where Russian operatives came to London, traveled to the town of Salisbury, where they poisoned former Russian spy Sergei Skripal.
Right. So is there any knowledge now what Gebrev was poisoned with? I mean, is there any suggestion that it was a similar type of nerve agent to what Sergei Skripal was poisoned with?
No, there's not a lot of details on what he was poisoned with. It was some kind of an organophosphate poison, which is a substance that is found in a lot of fertilizers. There's as yet no information that would suggest that the poison used on him was similar to the one that was used on Skripal. However, the delivery method was somewhat similar. The poison in the Skripal case was administered to his front door. Similarly, in Bulgaria, the poison was smeared on the door handles of the car cars belonging not only to Gebrev, the arms manufacturer, but also his son and a top executive in his company.
You said that initially the suspicion was this was the work potentially of business rivals, but now the prosecutor in Bulgaria has issued a warrant for three Russians. How do we know that they sort of joined the dots there?
Well, again, you have to look back to the Skripal case, which is really what blew this whole thing open. Following the poisoning in the UK, British authorities went around to their allies with lists of potential Russian operatives who had believed to be involved in the Skripal case, and began putting their heads together on who these individuals might be. This led them to Bulgaria, where a number of the individuals who appear to have been involved in the poisoning of the arms manufacturer were also involved in the planning And operational stages of the Skripal case.
In terms of this Bulgarian arms dealer, Emilian Gebrev, is there a suggestion that he was in some way going against what might be perceived to be Russian interests?
He was sort of nibbling away at Russian arms markets in countries like India and in North Africa. He was also involved at the beginning of the Russian-backed separatist war in Ukraine. So there were a number of things that might have angered the Kremlin, and it's possible that it was just a whole range of these activities.
Michael Schwartz speaking to the BBC's Tim Franks. You're listening to the Global News Podcast on the BBC World Service. Still to come.
It may well be surprising to find out that so many Brazilians have named their children after a player from Argentina. But I think Juan Román Riquelme, it almost transcended nationality.
Why, even in retirement, footballer Juan Román Riquelme is still a big name. Dozens of world leaders joined Holocaust survivors at a major event in Jerusalem on Thursday to mark the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz by Soviet troops. 1.1 million people, including more than 950,000 Jews, were murdered at the death camp in Nazi-occupied Poland. But in addition to remembering the victims, organisers of the commemorations stressed that the leaders would also focus on fighting modern-day anti-Semitism. Our correspondent Johnny Diamond reports from the ceremony at the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial Centre.
Presidents and prime ministers, royalty and congressmen rubbed shoulders. Some smiles amongst the handshakes, but the mood was sombre, the dress uniformly dark. When the liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau came, just 7,500 Jews were still alive there. Across Europe, Jewish bones filled pit after pit in the dark Central and Eastern European earth. Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, reminded the audience that of those 6 million dead, 1.5 million were children.
The tattooed arms of those who passed under its infamous gates, the piles of shoes and eyeglasses seized from the dispossessed in their final moments, the gas chambers and crematoria that turned millions of people into ash. It is the culmination of what can happen when our people have no voice, no land, no shield.
The US Vice President Mike Pence stood. His slow, measured speech remembered a Polish town turned into a place of incomprehensible horror.
When soldiers opened the gates of Auschwitz on January 27, 1945. They found 7,000 half-starved, half-naked prisoners. In its 5 years of existence, more than 1.1 million men, women, and children would perish.
Black-suited, snowy-haired, black-rimmed glasses, the German president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, stood at the lectern. His voice carried the weight of Germany's awful past, his focus not on the terrible scale of the killing, but again on individual victims.
Ida wrote her last letter to her parents. I quote, "I regret from the very depths of my soul that on departing, I did not realize the importance of the moment, that I did not hug you tightly, never releasing you. Germans deported them. Germans burned numbers on their forearms. Germans tried to dehumanize them, to reduce them to numbers, to erase all memory of them in the extermination camps.
And up stood one victim, one survivor, not like the others, bareheaded, but with a black broad-brimmed hat and a long black coat. Rabbi Israel Meir Lau, chairman of Yad Vashem, had been sent to Buchenwald, aged 7.
Let's forget it. Let's open a new page, a new chapter. Let's forgive, let's forget. So I came especially to tell you, I cannot forgive because I'm not authorized to forgive. My parents, before they went away, before they were taken away, they didn't ask me to forgive. They asked me to continue the chain, that the Jewish chain will be unbroken, unbroken forever. That's what they said.
His Excellency Mr. Rumen Radev, President of the Republic of Bulgaria.
Then one by one, the 50 or so leaders stood and walked on stage, grim-faced men and women in black, their heads full of what they had just heard and seen, hanging wreaths to make a wall of them. And a cantor sang El Malai Rachamim, the prayer for the Jews murdered in the camps of Europe. God full of mercy, he sang, who dwells in the heights, provide a sure rest for all the souls of the 6 million Jews who were murdered, slaughtered, burnt and exterminated. Everlasting is their heritage. The Garden of Eden shall be their resting place, and they will stand for their fate in the end of the day. And let us say, Amen.
That report by Johnny Diamond. Juan Guaido is recognised by more than 50 countries as the leader of Venezuela, but President Nicolas Maduro remains very much in power, backed by the military. One of Mr. Guaido's staunchest supporters in the region is the Colombian president, Iván Duque. The BBC's Michal Hussein asked Mr. Duque if Juan Guaido's chance had gone.
Nicolas Maduro is the Latin American equivalent of Slobodan Milosevic. He's a war criminal. He has brutalized his country. He's a dictator. He's a tyrant. Juan Guaido is the legitimate president that Colombia and more than 50 countries have recognized as president of the assembly. And all is needed in Venezuela is to see free elections pretty soon. Venezuela has lost more than 6 million people that have fled the country. Colombia has received 1.6 million migrants. We have had a comprehensive and fraternal migration policy.
He has presided over an economic crisis, but you are essentially calling him a warlord.
He is a warlord, but it's not just because I'm saying it. He was denounced before the International Criminal Court by myself and other heads of state. And he has also been denounced by the Secretary General of the OAS for genocide, targeting opponents, killing people, imprisoning people without a fair trial. And he has destroyed all the economy. And let me tell you something that is very worrying. In 1 month, Venezuela will be running out of vaccines. And this represents a major threat in health and security for Latin America. Why? Because he has destroyed any single opportunity of having fair jobs for people.
So can you take in more Venezuelans?
We have taken 1.6 million, and it has created a lot of pressure. But we have done it because it is our moral duty to support our brothers and sisters who are coming to Colombia with frozen bones, lack of medicine, and dying of hunger. Can we take more? Certainly, we can take more. But the thing is, this is not about how many people Colombia can take. This is about the need, the world to know that the need is the tyranny to stop so that this massive flow of migration can stop and that we can reestablish economic growth in Venezuela with a comprehensive plan that have been designed the sign by multilateral agencies like the Inter-American Development Bank.
But hasn't the moment of Juan Guaido's chance to oust President Maduro passed now?
It's not just Juan Guaido. And I've heard many people saying in the last year, Guaido hasn't been able to knock down Maduro. Guaido is a person who in democracy, with the use of word and calling the people, has faced the most brutal dictatorship we have seen in Latin America's recent history. Is it easy for him alone to put an end to a dictatorship? Of course. That's why it has to be a global effort. That's why there has to be a joint effort between the Lima group, the comprehensive group that was built in Europe, everyone, to getting to just one purpose for 2020, and is the call for free elections in Venezuela. Those free elections must come with an economic reactivation plan, because it's the only way Venezuela can see light at the end of the tunnel. And this is not just Juan Guaido's work. His leadership is crucial. It's necessary. It's pivotal. But the most important thing is that we all support that transition in Venezuela.
The president of Colombia, Iván Duque. And now, a voice from the past. That may not be as melodious as Ella Fitzgerald singing Summertime, for example, but it's perhaps just as historic. According to a team of British scientists, what you just heard is the voice of Nesyamun, an Egyptian priest who lived over 3,000 years ago. The team from Royal Holloway, Leeds and York Universities recreated a 3D model of the mummified priest's larynx. Professor David Howard from Royal Holloway University introduced me to the mysterious Nesyamun.
Nesyamun was a priest in the time of Ramesses XI in Luxor in Egypt, living around about 3,000 years ago. And his role was to sing the divine services on a regular basis in Luxor.
And his voice, therefore, was absolutely essential to his reason for being, his job. How did you manage to recreate his voice?
We started on the basis that Nesyamun himself, when you look at his hieroglyphics, means true of voice. And he was keen that his voice allowed him to speak after his death. That is recorded as one of the things that he was very keen on. And in some way, when we first heard this sound, we felt that perhaps we had had some part in granting that wish. But the process we engaged in was to take his body in his sarcophagus to Leeds General Hospital, where he was put into a scanner, CT scanner, and we scanned the area of his head from the neck where the larynx is to his lips. We then take that file into a computer that can identify the difference between the air, the soft tissue, i.e. skin, and the hard tissue, i.e. bone, and we capture the airway within the computer. You then put a virtual 3D sheath around it, which you abstract the sheath itself and 3D print that, so you end up with a plastic replica of exactly his airway between his larynx and his lips.
You must have put in an awful amount of brain power and passion into this. So how did it feel for you to hear his voice for the first time?
There was something extremely special about that, because you plan this kind of project, you assume that your tools are the right way to do it. It wasn't about the quality of the sound itself. It was about where it had come from, and it was the end of a long journey to get to that point. And that was a very special team moment.
Do you do requests? Because I wouldn't mind hearing Napoleon or Robert the Bruce in future.
If you have Robert the Bruce's body, please bring it round.
Right, so what do you need in order to...
Yeah, we need an accurate representation of the tube from the larynx to the lips. So having the opportunity to work with Nesyamun, of course, was special here because, yes, he's 3,000 years old, but because of the mummification process, his vocal tract is well preserved.
Professor David Howard. Now, staying in that time period, give or take a millennium, nearly 2,000 years ago, Mount Vesuvius in Italy erupted. The damage to the surrounding areas near modern-day Naples was catastrophic. Thousands of people died. Now, in what's thought to be the first time ever, scientists have discovered that the heat from the blast turned one victim's brain to glass. The BBC's Kate Gregan has the story.
On the 24th of August, AD 79, a volcanic mountain came to life and two cities met their deaths. The eruption of Vesuvius consumed Pompeii and Herculaneum with falling pumice stone, ash and heat. Now it's been revealed that the heat was so intense that it turned one victim's brain to glass. Dr. Pier Paolo Petrone from the University of Naples had been studying the remains of one victim when he made the discovery.
I saw within the skull, because the skull was totally exploded and the skull was full of ash, but within the ash, I saw some black small fragments shining. And I said, what is this? So I just went very near, so just to clean and to take one or two of these fragments. And I could see that it was just the remains of the brain. That was clear because this kind of black fragments were found only within the skull. So it was very clear that it was just vitrified brain.
The victim is believed to be a man in his mid-20s. He was discovered lying on a wooden bed buried by volcanic ash. The researchers say the 500-degree heat created by the eruption was enough to burn the victim's fat and body tissues before a rapid cooling process caused vitrification. But that might not be the end of the story.
So now we should do the process back to try to liquefy again this material and to see if we can find something more, for instance, like DNA.
That's right, DNA. But Dr. Petrone did say that this would be almost impossible.
Kate Gregan. Football defences, beware. Riquelme is back. 11 Riquelmes, in fact. What's more, these young stars, named for Argentina's talismanic number 10, are Brazilian. They're all taking part in this year's Sao Paulo Junior Football Cup, a competition for teams of players under the age of 20 in Brazil. Their parents were clearly admirers of Juan Román Riquelme, even though he starred for Brazil's most competitive rivals. Our South America football correspondent Tim Vickery puts into context just how good the original Riquelme was.
I think the heart of this story is, in football as in life, it ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it. Because there have been many footballers who have won more things than Juan Román Riquelme, but it's what he was. He was an old-fashioned, foot-on-the-ball playmaker from an unhurried age. It almost seemed, you know, when Riquelme was playing, that he'd stepped out of an old football annual in black and white. He was a real throwback in that way. And in an age where so much is rush and hurry and in life, as in football, intensity and running around all the place. Well, Riquelme didn't do a lot of that. He'd put his foot on the ball. He'd make a little pass. He'd receive the ball again. He'd survey the situation. And then he'd play the killer pass. It was an artistic way of playing football. I think defending against Juan Román Riquelme reminds me a little bit of one of the early opponents of Muhammad Ali, who was having these punches coming at him from all angles and said, you know, things all went fuzzy for me gradually all at once. And that's a little bit the way that Riquelme took defences to pieces. He would pass and pass and pass and pass and then play the killer blow, and things would go fuzzy for the opposing defenders gradually all at once.
Now, I'm Scottish and I don't know of any Scottish children called Gascoigne or Rooney. Is it odd for Brazilians to pay tribute to a hero of their international rivals?
It's not odd to have your child named after famous footballers. I've come across quite a few Linekers in my time over here. Kids who were born, you know, in the late 80s or early 90s, when the former England centre-forward was in his pomp. And it may well be surprising to find out that so many Brazilians have named their children after a player from Argentina. But I think Juan Román Riquelme, it almost transcended nationality and was a symbol of old-fashioned South American football, not just Argentine, but South American.
And lastly, in the Sao Paulo Junior Football Cup, there are 11 Riquelmes, a team of Riquelmes. In real life, would a team of Riquelmes do well?
Very good point. There wouldn't be a lot of running around going on. I'm not sure they'd win too much, but I'd pay to see them.
Tim Vickery. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jonathan Savage. Until next time, goodbye.